sort of asymptotically high densities where perturbative methods can be used. This you've seen before, it's kind of an extremely schematic phase diagram, and it sort of illustrates the difficulty we have in understanding the phase diagram of very dense matter. There's roughly two regimes about which we know something. There's the regime of very low density, which is the regime of kind of traditional nuclear physics, where nuclear matter and neutron matter sits. There's the regime of extremely large density, where we have all of these exotic quark matter phases that I'll be talking about. And then, of course, there's the regime in between, about which we really know extremely little. They're really, by the way, in two sorts of nuclear matter. There's sort of ordinary nuclear matter with roughly equal numbers of neutrons and protons. That's the famous first-order transition to a self-bound system that cannot exist at arbitrarily low density. But the matter that you have in neutron stars is one that exists at finite electron chemical potential, so it's very neutron-rich. Pure neutron matter is a system of positive pressure, so that can actually exist at arbitrarily low density. So along this line, you can have arbitrarily low density, then eventually we reach into these extremely dense phases. About the low density regime, we know something because we do know what the interaction between nucleons, what that is like, and we can use that as the starting point for many body calculations. In addition to that, we of course have phenomenology of heavy nuclei and of neutron stars. It's again the regime of moderate density that's extremely difficult. We really know extremely little about the equation of state. What is the pressure? What is the speed of sound of very dense matter? And as Igor mentioned, there's all these speculations already in this regime about various exotic states, about hyperbolic matter, about ion, kaon condensates, and so on. What exactly is the nature of neutron pairing in very dense matter? And then we get to the high density regime where quark matter lives. Of course, again, at moderate density, we don't really have that under control very well, but at very high density, it becomes perturbative. So that's what I just said. So that I don't really have to reiterate. This is what Igor says. If you started at extremely high density, you can just perturbatively analyze what quarks do near Fermi surface. The main observation is that, unlike electrons, quarks actually attract one another already through the leading order interaction, and they do that in the channel where the colors of the two quarks are anti-symmetric. That's kind of obvious because, roughly speaking, that's the channel that you use in order to build ordinary baryons. The ordinary baryon is three quarks, all of different colors, so if that sub-channel of two quarks with different colors wouldn't be attractive, it's somewhat hard to see how you would find them. So near Fermi surface, that destabilizes the Fermi surface even if the interaction is arbitrarily weak. And of course, the way that gets resolved generically is by the formation of these pair condensates. And in QCD, what makes the phase structure so rich is the fact that a difermion condensate has a lot of indices to play with. In QCD, the indices are the colors of the fermions, the flavors of the fermions, and the Dirac spin indices. But in perturbation theory, you can study the phase structure. Of course, roughly speaking, what you do is you simply compute the thermodynamic potential of the system as a function of this order parameter, which is some complicated matrix, and then you minimize. And since this matrix has so many indices, of course, in practice, what you do is you consider kind of classes of order parameters that have certain residual symmetries, and you kind of go down in symmetry. You try the most symmetric one first, and then you try less and less and less symmetric ones, and it gets sort of richer and richer. Again, in perturbation theory, you can simply do that by just computing the thermodynamic potential perturbatively. So there's a series of diagrams like this, quarks and gluon loops, and the interactions between them. And of course, if you're interested in phases with pairing, then all of these fermion propagators, they contain these pair condensates that modify their structure. But you compute them variationally by minimizing the thermodynamic potential and taking a derivative of some expansion like this with respect to the pairing gap and generates these gap equations that are sort of schematically of this type, the self-consistency equation that determines the gap in terms of diagrams like this. The thing that's interesting in QCD, or the thing that was first observed by Son is that in addition to the sort of standard BCS expression that gives gaps that are exponentially small in the coupling, there's an extra logarithmic enhancement that comes from the fact that this exchange gluon, if it's a magnetic one, is only dynamically screened, so it's very weakly screened. And that gives kind of an extra logarithmic enhancement in these gap equations and makes the gaps parametrically larger. What is useful for discussing the phase structure is to realize that this gap equation is actually exactly the same to leading order in all of these phases, at least all the homogeneous ones. And the only thing that changes is the scale inside this log. And this scale then ends up determining the numerical coefficient in front of the gaps. So the gaps are generically exponentially small in 1 over the coupling constant. And the exact nature of the phase ends up showing up in the pre-exponent as an kind of numerical sort of group theory factor. The thermodynamic potential, the carrying energy you gain, is generically of the form density of states on the Fermi surface times carrying gap squared. And again, that's where these numerical coefficients can end in. A couple more remarks. Of course, if you study this perturbatively, at some point you should try to understand what exactly the range of validity of perturbation theory is. And sometimes we don't really know that. We haven't really pushed these calculations sufficiently high. So what is known, that is what Son computed, this coefficient C that appears in the exponential suppression. We also don't know what the overall coefficient is in all of these phases. But the next terms have not been completely computed. So we don't, in some sense, we don't really know how well convergent this really is. We do know the structure of the expansion generically. It's powers of g, logarithms of g, and at higher orders, even fractional powers of g. These are exactly the same fractional powers that Tony Bethan talked about earlier this week, and they come from this kind of non-Fermi liquid behavior. So that looks kind of disturbing, that the expansion parameter is really only something like g to the 1/3 or g to the 2/3. But things may actually not be that bad, but the truth is we don't really know. The thing we actually do know is that non-perturbative effects, things associated with instantons that are formally down by the extra exponential suppressions, like e to the minus 1 over g squared, these we can compute, and we actually do know where they become large. And they become large already at relatively large chemical potentials on the order of a GeV or so. And that's simply the standard fact about instanton calculations in QCD, which is that even though this is a gigantic suppression, the numerical factor in front is very large in QCD, so that these effects start to compete with some ordinary perturbative effects in the regime that we're really interested in. So what that means in the end is that, of course, the magnitudes of these gaps are really quite uncertain, except in a sense in very strong coupling, because there's sort of a speed limit that, you know, the gaps cannot really become much larger than some finite fraction of the chemical potential, which if you believe in these sort of cold atomic experiments is roughly a quarter. So if the coupling becomes so large that you run into this sort of speed limit, then in some sense it doesn't really much matter anymore what the coupling is. So there's sort of a high density regime where the gaps are really quite uncertain, and at sort of moderate densities they actually become more certain because the coupling is so strong that the gaps are just as large as they can ever get. What is also true that for a discussion of the phase structure, some of these things actually don't really matter all that much. Whether you think that the dominant interaction is perturbative gluons or it's instantons or some other thing, again, that affects what the magnitudes of these gaps actually are. But the favored phases tend to be the same with any of these interactions. So that's a little bit of an empirical statement, but that appears to be true. So I quickly wanted to sort of run through what the result is if you change the number of colors and flavors in QCD for these superfluid phases that you encounter at very large density. A little bit of an oddball is actually just a single flavor. So if QCD just had a single quark, think of it as the strange quark, say. In that case, you can't make the regular BCS sort of spin up, spin down condensate because the two colors of the quarks are supposed to be anti-symmetric. And you can't make it anti-symmetric in spin since you don't have a flavor index to play with. And as a result, you have to go sort of one spin higher and you get a spin one superfluid. The spin direction, you can actually couple into the color direction and make something that's sort of analogous to the B phase of helium-3, or this color flavor lock phase that Ivo already mentioned. So that's why I started calling this the color spin lock phase. The thing that's sort of amusing about it is that, in principle, that since this is spin 1, it breaks rotational invariance. But since the spin gets coupled into color, and the air actually doesn't, so the color times rotational symmetry in this phase gets broken into sort of a modified rotational symmetry. So the thing actually is rotationally invariant. And what that implies is that the spectrum will be somewhat unusual. This ordinary spin labeling gets messed up. And so in this phase, you have kind of six fermions, the three colors and two spins. And they fall into two multiplets. One is a spin 3 half, which is the one with the smaller gap. And the other one is a spin 1 half. And this amuses me to no end, because it means that the lowest excitation in this phase is a spin 3 half baryon. And that's kind of the right answer in one flavor QCD, because in one flavor QCD, also the ground state baryon has to be spin 3 half. So in one flavor QCD, the ground state baryon, of course, is the delta plus plus. So that may or may not mean anything. The next phase is the two flavor one, and that again, Ivo already discussed it at length. You have two flavors now, so these two flavors can simply be up and down. The colors are different. That means you pick kind of a direction in color space. Now, this epsilon ABC in color has kind of one index open. So if you give this order prominent expectation value, you break SU3 color down to SU2. So it's not actually fully Higgs. Part of the gauge symmetry remains unbroken. The flavor symmetry remains unbroken too, since this is an SU2 flavor singular. So the chiral symmetry in this phase is unbroken. It's not actually fully gapped. There are six fermions, so the two flavors, well, really 12, two flavors, the three colors and the spins. But out of the fermions, only four are gapped. The remaining two that live in kind of unbroken SU2 initially have no gap at all, and then by secondary mechanisms, we get some very, very small gap. The one thing that this breaks, it breaks the axial U1. So if you go to very high density, the anomaly will be suppressed. You get a very light UA1 Goldstone boson in this phase. And this unbroken SU2 will then eventually, since the corresponding fermions are gapped, will actually eventually get confined at some very low scale, even at arbitrarily large chemical potential. So the phase that everybody loves is, of course, the three-flavored one, where we use the beautiful accident that now the number of colors and the number of flavors is the same. So we can write down this extremely symmetric state. It's so symmetric that it's also, it produces the largest gap out of all of these phases I ever looked at. So you make the flavor indices anti-symmetric, you make the color indices anti-symmetric. That both cases kind of leaves an index dangling. You just contract that dangling index in color and flavor. It's called color flavor lock because that effectively entangles the color and the flavor wave functions of the pairs. That's sort of an odd situation because color, after all, is something dynamical. The interaction is about flavor, some kind of global symmetry. So what that does is it provides a very unusual mechanism for chiral symmetry breaking, because both the SU3 left and SU3 right flavor symmetries get broken by this kind of condensate. However, there's again a residual symmetry because you can always compensate for flavor rotations by doing color rotations. The color is vectorial, so you can't maintain the full chiral symmetry. You can only maintain the vectorial part. So you break SU3 left plus SU3 right to SU3 flavor. So that, of course, is ordinary chiral symmetry breaking, but through sort of an unusual mechanism because the pairs themselves are purely left or purely right. So sort of a secondary mechanism for chiral symmetry breaking. But of course, it has all the usual consequences that eventually a psi bar psi will form, there's a light pion, there's a f pi, and so on. It also means that the fermions of my theory, these gap fermions, they organize themselves into flavor multiplets. The flavor multiplets are not triplets like ordinary quarks, but they're octets and singlets like ordinary baryons. And indeed, if you compute the charges of these objects, they're the charges of ordinary baryons, so the integer electric charges. So that's again this kind of amusing continuity phenomenon. I once amused myself by looking at theories with more than three flavors, see what would happen.
But in case of three flavors, this flavor seemingly was not exact, right, from the very beginning. So in this way, when you are saying that, I mean, you're still...
You mean the French programs?
No, I mean, just, and let's say generically, everything is global. Right?
Yeah, well, we'll get to it. Yeah. With that most symmetric start to break.
Right, so in this way, it's not like, you are preventing, still maintaining some symmetry, right? Because regional clever symmetry was not exact.
So I'll get to that. But I spent most of these talks on how to break flavor symmetry. So for what happens for more than three flavors, again, it'll not be quite that symmetric because the CFL phase was really based on that bizarre accident that the number of colors, the number of flavors is the same. So for more than three flavors, you get phases that are sort of CFL-like in the sense that color and flavor symmetries kind of get entangled and at least part of the chiral symmetry gets broken. But none of these phases is quite symmetric enough to manage the sort of miracle to break chiral symmetry in exactly the zero density way. So none of these things manages to do SUN cross SUN goes to SUN. They do things that are sort of moderately close to that, like this one manages SU4 cross SU4 goes to SU2 squared, not SU4. So they get kind of close, they break chiral symmetries, but none of them break it in quite the QCD way. Another thing that was already mentioned, you can study what happens if you go to very many colors. For very many colors, the quark scattering is more and more suppressed relative to quark hole scattering. Because if you scatter a quark and a hole, then you can have the usual trick that this color runs around these loops, and every loop gives a factor of n. Whereas if you scatter two quarks, then their colors are fixed, and you don't get the factor n. So a very, very large number of colors, eventually, the superfluidity loses out to what I tend to call the chiral density wave. So a particle hole pair condensate that has a spatial modulation with the Fermi momentum. So it's an inhomogeneous version of chiral symmetry breaking that uses only part of the Fermi surface. And Sahn and Schuster once studied how large n has to be to run into this phase. And it's an example where large n isn't actually all that close to the, well, where large n is close to the real world, but infinite n is not. Because this tends to happen for moderately large chemical potentials, only for n's that are incredibly large. So this superfluidity, while only suppressed in the large n, then it is actually very robust. So the thing that becomes important towards the real world is the fact that the strange quark mass in particular, it's not zero, so the state doesn't exactly have a three-flavor symmetry. So what that tends to do to pairing is, again, what Igor already mentioned. So I have a light fermion that's almost massless, and it wants to pair with a heavy fermion, like the strange quark. Then for a given Fermi energy or given chemical potential, the Fermi momenta are no longer the same. So a quark that sits at a lower Fermi momentum has to pair with a quark that sits at a higher Fermi momentum in this BCS way that doesn't quite work. Because BCS is based on this trick that the total momentum of a BCS pair is zero. So that tends to disfavor BCS pairing. And the relevant parameter is how far the Fermi surfaces are pushed apart. And that's just kinematics, so that's the mass squared over the Fermi momentum. Also, once you reduce the Fermi momenta of the heavier fermions, like the strange quark, then in three-flavor QCD, you have this other accident that the electric charges of the quarks actually just add up to zero, which means that three-flavor symmetric quark matter is automatically electrically neutral. But once you reduce the number of strange quarks relative to up and down, it's no longer automatically neutral, requires a chemical potential to neutralize, and then again there's another thing that pushes the Fermi surfaces apart. So a lot of people have studied this problem over the last couple of years. And the kind of strategy that I want to talk about here is to concentrate on this three flavor case and go to infinitely high chemical potential. They are very large. This is the CFL phase. Of course, at infinite chemical potential, strictly speaking, there's other flavors, but I'm interested in perturbations in the CFL phase. So I concentrate on three. So then at infinitely large chemical potential, I should be able to study derivatively in some controlled way what is the response to a strange quark mass. And of course, as usual, since the CFL phase is a phase with broken chiral symmetry, there should actually be a lot of constraints on this, because whenever you have a broken chiral symmetry, then the response to a mass is simply governed by chiral symmetries, constrained by chiral Lagrangians. So the strategy I have in mind is that we're interested in modifications in the CFL state due to a strange quark mass that should be governed by a corresponding effective field theory that expresses broken chiral symmetry in the CFL phase. That effective field theory, of course, is only valid at energies that are less than the gap, so it's valid very close to the Fermi surface. And it'll only be valid as long as this strange quark perturbation itself is, again, ms squared over 2pf, has to be less than this. But in perturbative QCD, the thing that I can do that I cannot do in ordinary QCD is to compute the coefficients of this effective Lagrangian itself from perturbative QCD. And in practice, it's somewhat useful to actually layer yet another effective field theory in between the microscopic one and the chiral one. And that's sort of an effective theory for this non-Fermi liquid regime of QCD that Tony talked about again earlier this week, where all these funny logs and fractional columns appear. So in practice, the way the calculation works is that I write down a theory for this non-Fermi liquid regime with coefficient fixed in perturbative QCD. I use that theory to determine the coefficients of a chiral theory that describes the CFL phase, and I use the chiral theory to study the response to MS. So the theory that I use in this non-Fermi liquid regime is one where I imagine that I take my very large Fermi surface and I cover it with a number of patches that are labeled at a local Fermi velocity. And what I can do then is to take the Dirac spinners of the original theory QCD and remove the large Fermi momentum locally so that all the remaining Fermi undergoes freedom only very smoothly despite the very large Fermi momenta. In addition to that, in the vicinity of a Fermi surface, you don't really have 4 degrees of freedom corresponding to quarks in any quarks. You only have quarks in holes. So you reduce from kind of 4 spinners to 2 spinners locally on some near the Fermi surface. And then the effective theory for these particles in holes looks very much like a non-relativistic theory, sort of like a heavy quark theory, where the coupling is V dot V, and it contains kinetic terms like V squared over 2 mu. And what one has to do in this non-Fermi liquid regime is, again, the usual thing that one has to put in these HDL vertices that Tony talked about. So those describe, for example, screen gluons and dent gluons and so on. So for my purposes, what's most important is what quark masses do to this non-Fermi liquid theory. Again, you can kind of systematically determine that by removing antiparticle in high energy degrees of freedom. One of the things you get is simple shifts in the Fermi energy that are proportional to m squared over 2pf. That's really just expanding out a kinetic energy term near the Fermi surface. If it's squared of p squared over m squared, and you expand that near pf, of course, you get a whole tower of terms, the m squared over 2pf, m to the 4 over pf cubed, and so on. And diagrammatically, the way you can think about them is that the original theory, of course, had linear mass terms. But these linear mass terms couple fermions to antifermions. The antifermions you remove from your theory. So the effective theory only has operators that correspond to a linear transition to an antiparticle, and then you come back. These mass terms are quadratic in M, so in some sense they're not chiral breaking. They connect right-handed fermions with right-handed fermions, and left-handed with left-handed. The quark masses also affect the interactions in the theory. You might, for example, think that a quark mass term might somehow modify effectively the port-gluon interaction. It doesn't actually do that if you look more closely. The leading thing that happens is that it modifies or generates local four fermion interactions that can take two right-handed quarks and flip them into two left-handed quarks. And roughly speaking, the process that that corresponds to is that a right-handed quark emits a very hard gluon. That's not part of my effective theory, so really it goes into an operator that scatters quarks. So this is a very hard gluon that's effectively point-like, and then the chiralities get flipped by a quark. So that turns out to be the leading operator, some kind of BCS operator that's proportional to m squared with the mu squared. And again, there's a whole tower of these operators that we can determine what they are. So that then goes into a chiral theory. One can do that sort of through matching procedures, but I wanted to give kind of a hand-waving argument of how that happens. So the way you can get the chiral theory is that, roughly speaking, you write down this effective theory in the non-Fermi liquid regime, and you now put in gap terms that correspond to the CFL phase, and you put in chiral fields that allow you to rotate the direction of these gap terms in SU3 flavor, because that's what's supposed to parameterize the Goldstone boson, local flavor rotations of the condensate. So I put in these fields X and Y that parameterize the orientation of this pair condensate for left-handed and right-handed pairs. So these are matrices that act on color and flavor, and in the CFL phase, they would just be diagonal matrices with all ones. The Goldstone bosons correspond to small oscillations of these matrices around their vents. So quark loops, if you integrate them out, generate kinetic terms for these fields X and Y. And if you integrate out sort of quark and quark pairs and hard gluons, then you end up with an effective Lagrangian that contains only gauge invariant low energy degrees of freedom. These X's and Y's, since they know about the color orientation, they're not gauge invariant degrees of freedom. So the gauge invariant degrees of freedom you wind up with is the relative orientation of the left and the right-handed fields. That's a pure flavor matrix. And that's indeed the thing that parameterizes the Goldstone manifold. So this corresponds to an octet and a singlet of ordinary Goldstone bosons, like pions, kaons, and etas. And in some way, the way you can think about this is, since these X's and Y's parameterize dichore condensates, it's not really a quark-anti-quark pair, but it's more like a dichore anti-dichore kind of field. It's something that parameterizes the relative orientation of these pair condensates. In addition to that, if you keep fermion sources in your theory, you wind up with some gauge invariant fermion field. That again now has to be an octet field, not a triplet field. But in the Higgs phase, you can always do that. The fermion fields have colors. I can make it gauge invariant by convoluting the color on the fermion field with the color on my Higgs field, and I have a gauge invariant fermion field in my theory that describes this octet and singlet of baryons. And again, the way you can think of this is that the quark surrounds itself with some kind of dipole cloud. That's roughly speaking why it looks like an ordinary baryon. So the effective theory for that, in some sense, you don't even have to derive. You know what it is just from the symmetries. It's ordinary, since the symmetry breaking is the ordinary pattern. Since the symmetry breaking is the ordinary pattern, it has to be ordinary chiral perturbation theory. The only exception being that since Lorentz invariance is now broken, only rotational invariance is a good symmetry. So whereas ordinary chiral perturbation theory only has a single two derivative term with one coefficient called fi, this theory now has two terms because it has independent coefficients on the temporal derivative and the spatial ones. And that extra coefficient simply parameterizes the velocity of a Goldstone boson, which no longer needs to be one. In addition to that, it'll have mass terms, just like ordinary chiral perturbation theory. Here the difference is that, since at very large density, all the leading effects are actually quadratic in the Koch masses. At least perturbatively, the usual trace m sigma term is missing. That only gets generated by instantons. And the leading perturbative terms are all of these quadratic in the quark masses. So they're of this structure, trace m sigma squared. If you keep the fermion sources, again, you have these gauge invariant fermion fields. And again, that's completely dictated by chiral symmetry, how they interact with Goldstone bosons. So there's sort of a V dot D, that's now a flavor covariant derivative. And you have these usual F and D terms for the coupling of baryons to mesons.
There is one more term in normal chiral theory, which is associated with GA, and it's not written here.
G?
Yeah. No, 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 no. I mean, not interaction with external current, but interaction of nuclei with spire, that there is additional structure.
The interaction of the nuclei with the pire, well, the usual GA is some linear combination of P and F.
Right, that, but A mu is what? It's pi, and made of pi?
So this is an axial current made of pions.
Ah, yeah, then I agree. Yeah. No, I mean that, that it is, yeah.
So the thing that's usually called GA is some linear combination of
yeah.
P and F. And the other thing that happens in this theory is that, again, something that cannot happen at zero chemical potential is that these covariant derivatives on the Goldstone boson and nucleon fields, again, they contain effective chemical potential terms that arise because of this shift in the Fermi surface that comes from the Koch masses. So they're, again, covariant with respect to extra chemical potentials that contain the Koch masses. And all of these coefficients can now be determined, again, in perturbative QCD. So the Fi here, that was first calculated by Son and Stefanov, also computed this A. And again, for the baryons, you can compute what the values of these Ds and Fs are. So using this theory, you can then study this problem of what the Koch masses do. If you just want to know the phase structure, what the CFL order parameter does, you take the effective potential that's generated by our theory and use to minimize. So as a function of what the Koch masses are, what the M is, these mu's are, you just look for the minimum of this effective potential. And of course, for zero Koch mass, you'll find it's the regular CFL minimum, but then in general, you can move away from that. And if you want to know what the gaps of your various quasi-particles are, you again, you just look at the spectrum of fermion excitations that's described by the fermionic part. So in some given mesonic background, you just compute what the gaps actually are. And again, if the Koch masses are zero, you should find the regular CFL result, which is some kind of octet of gap delta and a singlet of gap 2 delta. But as soon as you turn on the Koch masses, these things will somehow move. So this is the result for the phase structure that you get out of this. So this is the function of the strange Koch mass and the light Koch masses in the regime that I assume, strictly speaking, this is sort of symmetric with rotation when you flip MS and MU. So here I already assumed that MS is the heavier of the two. Strictly speaking, this is only below the diagonal. And so what happens along the strange quark mass axis is that sooner or later, at any value of the light quark masses, the order parameter will rotate in the direction of an S wave, KL condensate. So these are these phases that I call SFL K0 or SFL K0 plus eta. And very small up and down quark mass, in addition to the KL condensate, you can have eta condensates also for some slightly obscure reason. So this is some kind of QCD realization of ordinary S-wave meson condensation. The reason that it happens in the kaon direction is simply that the CFL phase in response to a strange quark mass would like to reduce its strangeness content. That's not so easy because all of these strange quarks, they're kind of locked up by having been paired with other down quarks. So the easiest way the system can do that is to populate Goldstone bosons that have negative strangeness. And so by forming a Bose condensate of kaons, it can effectively reduce the strangeness content of the system. So the mechanism, in some sense, is the inverse of ordinary kaon condensation. The kaon condensation at low density was the idea that nuclear matter wants to add some strangeness to it. And one way you can do that is by generating kaons with positive strangeness. And the CFL phase kind of coming down, the strangeness oversaturated. And one thing it can do is generate post condensate of oppositely charged kaons. So you can compute what the critical strange quark mass is for this phenomenon to happen. and it's parametrically small, it's parametrically much smaller than the gap itself. And if you try to, this is a perturbative result, but luckily it doesn't actually have any power supply in it, so it's relatively robust. And if you just put into the typical numbers that this is something on the order of 100 MeV, and this is something on the order of 5 MeV or so, you get numbers here that are 40, 50 MeV, so you would think that this would actually happen in the real world. This slightly more obscure phenomenon of extra eta condensate, that only happens at up and down quark masses that are parametrically extremely small. It contains an obscure power of the strong coupling constant. So that kind of seems unlikely to me, but this is fairly robust. So this is the picture that Igor already showed, something I did with Andrei Kudrevsky a couple of years ago, is to compute the fermion spectrum in this phase. So here you see the gaps of the various excitations. Just for fun, I normalized the gap to 50 MeV, since I don't really know very reliably what it is. And then you can see that initially, this is an offset of fermions. There's actually another singlet that I didn't plot. It's up here. And this octet, once you turn on the strange quark mass, it splits. It initially splits in kind of a simple way, but then KM condensation happens, the background field becomes more complicated, the isospin gets broken in addition to just strangeness, or in addition to just flavor, and they split in even more complicated ways. So initially isospin is still conserved, and isospin gets spontaneously broken, and the spectrum becomes more complicated. And then you see that there is sort of an interesting point, which is the point where the first of these fermions become gapless. And that actually still, the theory starts to break down completely at exactly this point, which is why I stopped plotting. So this happens at least at very large chemical potential. This point is actually still a point where my theory is supposed to be reliable. So this ought to be a reliable prediction that the mode becomes gapless. And what a number of people have discovered, Igor in particular, that if you have a weakly coupled superfluid and you can have one of your fermions going gapless, then funny things tend to happen with thermodynamic instabilities. The way you see that in this kind of effective theory is that you can look whether this effective theory at some point becomes the ground state of the effective theory becomes unstable towards the formation of boson-boson currents. So boson-boson current is some kind of spatial modulation in the phase of the boson-boson field. So I have some kind of e to the I phi modulation, and if that phase is spatially dependent, then I generate vector and axial vector currents that are proportional to the variation of the phase. Now, ordinarily, that always costs energy. You know, there's no instability. And of course, the energy that it costs comes from the kinetic terms in your effective theory. So ordinarily, whenever you try to make a state like this, it costs energy and it's proportional to F pi, how much energy it costs. The thing that can happen near the point where a fermion goes gapless is that a background current through these axial and vector couplings in the effective theory will make an extra shift in the energy of the fermions. And since the coupling is V dot D, or V dot current, the extra shift is the velocity of the fermion times the magnitude of the current. So if you turn on a current, the thing that can happen is that you lower the energy of the fermions, and that can overcome whatever this costs. And it's more likely to help if the fermion is going very close to becoming gapless. If you take a bunch of fermions that are still gapped, turn on the current, and they all become ungapped at that point. And since this is directionally dependent, it will only happen on some sort of north pole of the fermi surface. So this is very analogous to something that Misha and Son analyzed for the cold atomic systems, where you have a very similar phenomenon because the effective theories are really not that different. So at that point, you can look at the effective potential as a function of this current that you're about to generate. And indeed, you see that if the fermion is very close to becoming gapless, that eventually there's some kind of first-order transition to turn on a current. In QCD, this current actually, in the end, this was without enforcing neutrality. The fermion that's coming down is an electrically charged fermion. So actually, electric neutrality very strongly suppresses the magnitude of this current. And so at the end of the day, that current turns out to be very, very small. That's actually kind of a good thing, because it means that the calculation again is actually very, very reliable. So initially, again, you have that gapless fermion. It generates a small current. You can think of this current, again, as some kind of P-wave KM condensate now, because now you have that extra spatial modulation. It's really completely analogous to this kind of P-wave ion condensate that Migdal talked about many, many years ago. So the place where the situation then becomes kind of uncontrolled, at least in my theory, is that, again, this is the boundary of my theory in principle. There's another mode that becomes gapless. That one's potentially more dangerous since it's neutral. But unfortunately, at this point, I cannot use this theory anymore since it is based on this kind of separation of scales, the perturbation being smaller than delta. That's the place where that's no longer true. So to conclude, we saw that the phase diagram, even in very weak coupling, is complicated. It depends in particular, crucially, on what the number of flavors, the number of colors, and the top masses actually are. The thing that's amusing, in particular, about this color flavor lock phase is that it provides kind of a weak coupling realization of things that we sort of ordinarily think of as being very non-perturbative, chiral symmetry breaking, these S and P wave meson condensates. Something I obviously did not talk about at all, and which luckily Igor talked about quite a bit, is these kind of constraints you have from technology. I obviously also didn't really talk at all about sort of ordinary nuclear matter and, you know, how the transition would work between nuclear matter and quark matter. And if I had to make sort of a guess of where strong coupling techniques might turn out to be useful, to me it's actually not so important to study these complicated superconducting phases, because they actually really depend, again, very crucially on what the masses actually are, what the flavor content really is. But I think it would be really much more interesting to look at the sort of no man's land, the strongly coupled dense matter, but not necessarily color superconducting. One thing that, for example, always strikes me is that if you look at the sort of best traditional nuclear theory of neutron stars, then these typical Urbana-Argonne kind of equations of state are extremely stiff. So beyond nuclear matter density, where we know what's going on, the velocity of sound quickly goes very close to the velocity of light. And that's actually very important to them, because that's how they make neutron stars that have masses that are about twice their solar mass. There's basically kind of a theorem that the largest neutron star mass you can ever get is you take the equation of state until the point where you think you know it, and then you continue with velocity of sound equal to velocity of light. That gives you the largest possible mass. And roughly speaking, that gives you this 2.3 m solar. So if anybody ever finds a star like this, and that means that these crazy equations of state that have velocity of sound equal to velocity of light, basically, they actually have, you know, they seem to be required. May not be true, but it could be true. And I have not the foggiest idea how something like that can be made. So it seems to me that even if you can make very crude models of what is sort of what dense matter looks like, even if all the details are wrong, what really interests me is what an equation of state typically looks like. Can you get nutty states where initially the velocity of sound is small, then over some range it actually goes much larger than a third, and then it goes back to this kind of quark matter limit? Or whether generically you approach the one third always from below, and you have these kind of soft equations of state that sort of continuously go into quark matter in these phases that we talked about. So it seems to me that there actually is a lot to be done, even with relatively crude models where all the details are wrong. I'm kind of asking qualitative questions about, you know, what the equation of state in a theory like this could look like. Well, thank you very much.
You talked about making NC very large, and you talked about making NF very large. What happens when NF equals NC and they're both made very large?
Yeah, the one thing that's kind of amusing, which I also once looked at, you would think that you know, four colors, four flavors, five colors, five, they should all be sort of like CFL. They basically should all be the sort of naive generalizations of the CFL phase. That turns out to be untrue. So for some reason, you not only need the miracle that NF is equal to NC, you also need them to be equal to 3 to get this truly beautiful phase where you realize exactly the right symmetry breaking pattern. And dynamically, the reason that that happens is that this phenomenon that the fermions organize themselves into flavor multiplets, that continues. So there are 5 flavors, and the 25 fermions, they go into a 24-plet and a singlet. But the splitting in the CFL phase, the splitting between the singlet and then F squared minus 1-plet, that grows with N. And these states become kind of very, you know, for 3 colors, it's a factor 2, but for N, it's N minus 1, I think. So that state energetically becomes kind of disfavored compared to sort of multiple embeddings of states where the apps are closer together. So in retrospect, I think it was kind of an accident that we got the CFL phase right. At the time, we didn't really worry about many of these issues. And there is indeed kind of, I don't know, entropic selection in the real world.
You can say abstractly that you want larger F and larger C, yes, and then in QCD there is a special point where beta function vanishes, right?
Yeah, so that's modulo.
And so around that value, or probably even smaller than F, there is also kind of conformal. There's completely new
window. It would be you need for this NF larger than C, extremes. So to come to the point where it finished.
No. I mean QCD-like theories, for example, first. And in QCD-like theories, this is, you know, there is a relation between NC and NF which make a zero, right?
So below this,
when I still have a symptomatic freedom, then we have this weaker coupling kind of conformal window. And so even that is very interesting by itself, but what would happen with nuclear physics, non-nuclear physics, I guess.
We recently were considering the low energy theory of the CFL phase without assuming any mass or chiral symmetry, so no mass for any of the quarks. But we put a magnetic field.
Yes.
And we found that even if you just stay with the very first, the leading terms, which would be essentially the covariant derivative type of terms of the sigma field, you get when the field overcomes, when the field is of the order of delta, you get the sum of the, to be more precise, the charged boson bosons decouple because they get masses. And then after that, what you have is the number of boson bosons is lower, is 5, and they are all neutral. So my question is, in your model, would it be affected if you put a magnetic field? Mm-hmm. Could you comment what would you expect to happen with the condensate? I know you have mass to begin with, but I imagine that similar effect will appear. We have some decoupling.
Yeah, but look, I don't know. I mean, you could, of course, now look since you already did this. I don't know. I don't have any intuition. But yes, you just use this model. Again, not a model.
The condensate that you have is not charged. I'm talking about rotated magnetic field. Okay? So rotated charge. It would be affected, for example, if you have condensation of charged particles or planets.
Right. But again, I mean, all you would really do is you take this thing and you put in the additional magnetic field. And I don't really know what would happen, but it's, you know, principle is straightforward. The thing that is true is that the condensator that I get are, of course, electrically neutral. I mean, they actually happen to be electrically neutral anyway, but of course, if you enforce electric neutrality, they have to be neutral.
Okay.
So you pick a neutral chaotic one, let's say, rather than a charged one.
You pick up the.
Yeah.
So you are talking about the rotated.
Yeah, no.
Charge.
Yeah, so this, well, so this, what I was saying is that this chaotic condensate is a neutral chaotic condensate, not a charged
one.
That happens for two, I mean, that's of course related to isospin breaking, which either comes from the difference between the up and the down quark or electromagnetism. And both of them turn out to favor the neutral one anyway. So in principle, if you split the up and the down quark masses, then of course it gets more complicated. In principle, you can get charged condensates, depending on what lepton chemical potential is.
Essentially, you also stay the same.
I'm afraid you're probably going to move on to the next one, so let's make the speaker.